Hello, ahlan wa sahlan, and welcome to another episode of Arab Voices, a syndicated radio talk show that airs on dozens of radio stations in the US and Europe since 2002. This is Saeed, executive producer and host of Arab Voices. During this episode of Arab Voices, episode number 1215, I will have three segments. First, we will listen to the Electronic Intifada newscast, a summary of the latest developments in occupied Palestine, including the ongoing Israeli genocide in the Gaza Strip and the ongoing Israeli atrocities in the West Bank, and the latest developments in Lebanon that is under constant bombardment by apartheid Israel. During the second segment, I will air the remarks delivered by representatives from the Council on American Islamic Relations, CARE, announcing the shocking findings from CARE's 2026 civil rights report titled The Right to Be Different, which documents a pattern of public officials using their offices to narrow the definitions of what Americans can look like, say, or believe in 2025. During the third segment, I will share with you the response of Dr. Omar Suleiman, a prominent Palestinian-American imam, to the Israeli government's, quote, top 10 prominent anti-Semitic influencers, unquote, list that includes his name. Let's begin with the Electronic Intifada newscast, a summary of the latest developments in occupied Palestine and Lebanon, presented by Noura Burrows-Friedman, Associate Editor at the Electronic Intifada.
This is the Electronic Intifada newscast. I'm Noura Burrows-Friedman, Associate Editor at the Electronic Intifada. It's day 937 of Israel's genocide in Gaza. Here's a brief summary of some of the latest developments this week in Palestine and Lebanon. In Gaza, Israel is killing and injuring Palestinians every day, nearly 7 months into the fraudulent ceasefire, while the health crisis is exacerbated by Israel's ongoing draconian blockade on essential items, including medicine, infrastructure materials, and fuel. As of Wednesday, Israel has killed at least 823 Palestinians and injured more than 2,300 in Gaza since the so-called ceasefire was declared in October 2025, according to the Palestinian Ministry of Health. On Wednesday, Israeli attacks killed 5 Palestinians and injured 7 across Gaza, including a paramedic, Ibrahim Sakhar, who was killed, according to the health ministry. Reporter Saad Hezbollah captured footage of Sakhar's colleagues collapsing in grief around his body. Israeli attacks on Tuesday killed 3 Palestinians, including a 9-year-old boy who was shot by an Israeli drone in eastern Khan Yunus. A relative speaking to reporters said that they don't have cooking gas to make food, so the child, Adel al-Najjar, was collecting cardboard scraps for his family to use as fuel. Dropsite News reports that Adel's younger brother had been killed under similar circumstances in the same area just a month ago. At least 226 children have been killed since the start of the fraudulent ceasefire. An Israeli airstrike killed 2 Palestinians in Gaza City in an attack on a vehicle. Reporter Wadia Abu al-Saud was asked by another journalist what happened in that attack. Abu al-Saud, whose hand was covered in blood, says that, quote, the whole world is saying that we have a ceasefire. I want to tell the world this is the blood of a martyr. Every day we have martyrs. Every day we have casualties. Every day there are violations. The occupation continues to target civilians, but the difference is that cameras and screens have been shut off from Gaza today. During the days of the genocide, they said there was global solidarity with us. Now there is no coverage, and they strike us every day. The siege is still ongoing. The healthcare system is collapsing. The education system has stopped. Every pillar of dignified life in Gaza has remained destroyed.
بحب أبلغ العالم هر دم الشهيد كل يوم في عنا شهداء كل يوم في عنا إصابات كل يوم في عنا خروقات الاحتلال ما زال مستمر باستهداف المدنيين ولكن الفارق إنها أغلقت الكاميرات والشاشات عن قطاع غزة اليوم اليوم العالم بيقول لك في هدنة في غزة زمان أيام حرب الإبادة كان يقول لك في تضامن معنا كان في تضامن عالمي معنا اليوم أغلقت الشاشات والكاميرات عنا وبصدونا كل يوم كل يوم في عنا شهداء كل يوم في عنا إصابات كل يوم في ليس الحصار مستمر، المنظومة الصحية متهالكة، المنظومة التعليمية متوقفة، كل أركان العيش الكريم في غزة، جميع مقومات العيش الكريم في غزة ما زالت مدمرة.
That was reporter Wadia Abu al-Saud. Israeli drones targeted and killed Imad Mikdad, a man who ran a solar-powered device charging point in Gaza City on April 25th. In addition to providing an essential service for his community, Mikdad was also the president of the Palestinian Billiards and Snooker Federation. On April 27th, the Israeli army killed a Palestinian teenager in northern Gaza. The Wafa news agency reported that Ayham al-Omari, 15 years old, was killed in the Beit Lahia area. 12 Palestinians were killed across Gaza on April 24th in a wave of airstrikes and tank shellings. Medical sources said that 3 people, 2 of them police officers, were killed in an Israeli strike in Gaza City, while 2 other police officers were killed in an attack in Beit Lahia. Another strike in Khan Yunus killed 7 others, including 4 police. Gaza's Ministry of the Interior and National Security stated that the strikes were yet another deliberate attack on police officers in an intentional effort to further destabilize the society in the Gaza Strip. A 4-year-old girl, Naya Al-Tanani, was injured in the attack in Gaza City and died of her injuries shortly thereafter. Reporter Nahed Hajjaj captured video of Naya's mother and relatives holding her small body, wrapped in a shroud soaked in blood at the hospital. On April 23rd, a child was shot in the neck by Israeli forces who fired from their army vehicles in Beit Lahia. Reporter Saad Hezbollah filmed Zeina Batah in the hospital in critical condition. As Israel maintains a brutal blockade on the Gaza Strip, preventing basic materials from entering while hundreds of thousands of families remain inside dilapidated tent shelters, an increase of rodent infestations has been reported. UNRWA, the United Nations Agency for Palestine Refugees, reported this week that in areas that are overcrowded with displaced families, especially in Khan Yunus and in locations with large amounts of rubble in Gaza City and North Gaza, an ongoing shortage of rodenticides have increased the risk of transmission of rodent-borne diseases such as leptospirosis and plague. Additionally, rat bites have been increasingly documented in multiple health facilities over the past months, the agency noted. A spokesperson for the Gaza municipality told the publication Middle East Eye in mid-April that, quote, despite our efforts to address the rodent problem, such as partial sewage interventions and removing random garbage dumps, we cannot eliminate the problem under current conditions. The scale of the disaster far exceeds available capacities, he added. Meanwhile, skin diseases and viruses such as scabies and chickenpox have surged, UNRWA added, due to a lack of basic sanitation services, medications, and hygiene supplies. Health experts say that the ability to control the problem is constrained by a severe shortage of pesticides, anti-lice shampoos, medical treatments, and calamine lotion. Israel extended the administrative detention of Dr. Hossam Abu Safia this week, with Israeli authorities indicating that his detention is now, quote, indefinite. Administrative detention is an Israeli practice of imprisonment without charges or a trial. Dr. Abu Safia, a pediatrician, was abducted by the Israeli army in December 2024 after soldiers raided the medical facility that he directed, Kamal Adwan Hospital in Beit Lahia, in northern Gaza. The hospital was then destroyed. Dr. Abu Safia is being held by Israel under its so-called unlawful combatants law, which allows itself to detain Palestinians from Gaza for prolonged periods without trial. Physicians for Human Rights in Israel said that the court, quote, upheld the detention despite arguments that detaining a doctor while performing his medical duties constitutes unlawful detention. The doctor's family said that he had been denied access to his lawyer for more than 2 months and is currently in the Ketziot prison in the Naqab Desert. They said that his health is severely deteriorating due to the physical violence Israeli guards have routinely inflicted on him, as well as ongoing significant weight loss and systematic medical neglect. Turning to the occupied West Bank, Israeli forces shot and killed a 37-year-old father, Abdel Halim Ruhi Hamad, in the town of Silwad, near Ramallah, early Wednesday morning. The General Authority of Civil Affairs stated that Israeli forces withheld his body. Israeli soldiers raided the town and carried out searches of Palestinian homes and assaulted the residents, witnesses told Anadolu News Agency. Soldiers also removed an injured person from inside the Ruhi family home during the raid, which began around 1:30 a.m. The Israeli army said in a statement that during an operational activity by army forces in the village of Silwad, two individuals attacked two Israeli soldiers, who were wounded and evacuated to a hospital. Hamad was the father of a 1.5-year-old child and the brother of Mohammed Hamad, who was killed by Israeli forces in 2021 and whose body is still being withheld, Wafa News Agency reported. Also on Wednesday, Israeli forces shot and killed a child, 15-year-old Ibrahim Abdul Fattah Al-Khayat, in the southern city of Al-Khalil during a raid. The local Wafa news agency reported that a large convoy of army vehicles stormed the Al-Hawoz area and sealed off the main street, denying Palestinian civilians free movement and ordering store owners to close their shops before storming the premises of a charity. The soldiers fired barrages of live ammunition, tear gas, and concussion bombs at the residents, resulting in casualties and the murder of the child, who was shot in the abdomen. Israeli forces shot and killed a Palestinian child last week on April 23rd during a raid into the northern city of Nablus, alleging that the child had been throwing stones at an armored military vehicle. 15-year-old Yusuf Sameh Eshtaya was killed by soldiers who opened fire on him. Hundreds of mourners gathered for his funeral procession through the streets of his village of Tel, near Nablus. The day before Israeli forces murdered Yusuf, Israeli settlers shot and killed a young Palestinian man in the town of Deir Dibwan, east of Ramallah. 25-year-old Auda Atef Awauda was shot in the back by settlers. On April 21st, Israeli settlers opened fire on a secondary school in the village of Al-Mughayr, killing 14-year-old Aus Hamdi Nassan and 32-year-old Jihad Marzouk Abu Naim. Witnesses who spoke to the New Arab said the settlers deliberately fired at the students with the intention of killing them. They added that Israeli forces provided cover for the settlers while beating back residents who were attempting to rescue their children. The New Arab reported that, quote, testimonies of the residents and the wounded taken at the specialized Arab hospital suggest that the attack was premeditated, with the settlers having attempted to divert attention away from the school ahead of the attack. Faraj Nassan, uncle of the slain student Aus Nassan, said the settlers attempted to storm the village in the morning from the southern side. After a confrontation with residents, the settlers withdrew to an area near the school. Eyewitness Kifah Nassan, who went to the school after hearing about settler activity nearby, said the Israelis fired directly at the school's windows, classrooms, and balconies. The army arrived shortly after and began dispersing the Palestinian residents and firing tear gas at them to keep them away from the school. Nassan suggested that the soldiers gave the settlers enough time to carry out the attack, arriving only after 15 or 20 minutes and pushing away the Palestinian residents. He described harrowing scenes of terrified students trying to escape, crawling out through balconies before residents were able to evacuate them. A paramedic said that he witnessed three settlers deliberately firing at children attempting to flee classrooms or even just stepping outside to see what was happening. According to the paramedic, the settlers parked their vehicles on a road west of the village known as Al-Kasarat, then climbed the hill overlooking the school, standing only about 50 meters away. He noted that one student was shot in the head and another who followed him was shot in the hand. That was from a report in the New Arab. The publication noted that the 14-year-old boy who was killed, Aus Hamdi Nassan, was the son of Hamdi Nassan, who was also killed by settlers in an attack in 2019. Hamdi had attempted to transport wounded people during a settler attack and successfully evacuated some, but was shot and killed while trying to rescue another. The United Nations Human Rights Office says that since the start of 2026, approximately 680 settler attacks have been recorded in over 200 Palestinian villages and towns, resulting in the full displacement of 9 Palestinian communities. Meanwhile, in Lebanon, Israel continues to kill and injure people while destroying entire villages in the south, in spite of a so-called ceasefire. Israeli attacks have killed more than 2,500 people and injured 8,000 since March 2nd, and have displaced more than 1.6 million from their homes. For more on the situation on the ground in Lebanon amid the political charade of a U.S.-brokered fraudulent ceasefire, our contributor Rokaya Chamsedine filed this report for the Electronic Intifada on Wednesday evening.
Rokaya Chamsedine reporting for the Electronic Intifada. While Washington attempts to portray a three-week extension of the U.S.-brokered ceasefire as a diplomatic breakthrough, the reality across South Lebanon reveals a war that has merely shifted its form. The State Department stabilization rhetoric serves as a hollow veneer for an Israeli campaign of ethnic cleansing that is struggling to translate aerial destruction into territorial control. What we are witnessing is a calculated attempt by the occupation to offset its salt ground offensive and its failure to establish dominance south of the Litani River. The human cost of this diplomatic theater is being written in blood through a series of documented massacres. In Jibshit, an Israeli airstrike recently wiped out 3 generations of an entire family. In Jweya, located in the district of Sur, just west of Ghana, Israeli bombardment killed 6 people, including a child. The depravity of these attacks reached a new threshold in Majdanzun, where a double-tap strike deliberately targeted rescue teams. After an initial Israeli airstrike, a second missile was launched as Lebanon civil defense teams worked to extract the wounded, killing 3 paramedics and a civilian mid-extraction. These relentless attacks are the frantic outbursts of an occupying force unable to secure the front lines through conventional combat. This pattern of targeting reached a chilling peak with the killing of veteran Al-Akhbar journalist Amal Khanin on April 22nd near At-Tire. Khanin was traveling with colleague and photojournalist Zainab Faraj when their vehicle was deliberately targeted. After seeking shelter in a nearby building, a subsequent strike hit the area, trapping Khanin under the rubble. Faraj was pulled out first, critically injured, but repeated Israeli attacks, including fire on Red Cross ambulances and the use of sound grenades, prevented rescuers from reaching Khanin. She remained trapped for over 7 hours before clearance was finally granted, by which time she was found dead. Her killing, alongside Faraj's critical injury, marks a blatant attempt to silence those documenting the occupation's failures in South Lebanon. While Israel's bombardment has claimed over 2,500 lives in Lebanon since the escalation in March, the resistance has responded with surgical strikes. In the final week of April, Hezbollah utilized fiber-optic-guided FPV drones to bypass aerial defenses, successfully targeting soldiers within occupation security zones. These operations have inflicted consistent casualties, including a strike in Taibe that killed an Israeli sergeant and wounded 6 others. Despite this aerial terror, the resistance has dismantled the myth of Israeli air superiority. Fighters recently brought down a multi-million-dollar Hermes 450 drone over Alcantara following the interception of an Hermes 900 Starliner. The dismantling of these strategic assets, occurring alongside the destruction of countless Merkava tanks, confirms that on the ground, every attempt to stabilize occupation zones has been met with a wall of fire, while the Israeli military resorts to scorched earth demolitions of border towns to fabricate a buffer zone. These actions reveal a military that has exhausted its strategic options. The message from the south is clear. The era of easy incursions is over.
That was Rokaya Chamsedine reporting for the Electronic Intifada from Lebanon on Wednesday. We've published many features in the last week, but we wanted to highlight how Israel ravaged Gaza City's Al-Zahra neighborhood by Amro Rashad Abu Aisha, writing from Gaza. He recounts his life in the Zahra neighborhood in southern Gaza City, which was made up of dozens of tall residential towers. Abu Aisha was forcibly evacuated from his apartment with his family in the early weeks of the genocide in October 2023. And these are excerpts from what he wrote about his displacement and the destruction of his community. Quote, life in Al-Zahra was peaceful, uninterrupted by the Israeli genocidal machine until October 19th, when our neighbor Abu Ahmed knocked on our door and told us that the Israeli army was about to bomb three of Al-Iskan towers. He advised us to unfasten our glass windows from their hinges and remove them entirely to prevent the glass from breaking during the bombardment, which might cause injuries. Around 10 minutes after we evacuated, a series of intense successive airstrikes, or fire belts, shocked the city. When the raid was over, I returned and saw the three towers leveled to the ground, as if an earthquake had struck them. I saw some of the grieving residents trying to collect their belongings or anything that could be useful. Others were looking at the rubble, weeping at their memories and the effort that had gone into buying the apartments, which were destroyed in minutes. I went back to our apartment, distressed and tired. I slept for 4 hours and woke up around 6 p.m. When I stood on the balcony, I saw a crowd of people heading toward our tower, panicked, some screaming and others holding bags. I left the apartment and walked downstairs at a fast pace, anxiously asking myself over and over, what now? I went to the crowd where I saw a man holding his phone and talking to an Israeli officer. The officer told him that the residents of the rest of Al-Iskan Towers should evacuate immediately. Unbelievable. Preposterous. The people denied that and thought that the Israeli army just wanted to bomb one or two of the towers. It is impossible, the residents argued, to wipe out 21 tall towers in such a short time. We couldn't imagine that. How naive we were. But all that uncertainty vanished after the first air raid obliterated one tower. We were horrified. Even though our tower in Al-Zafar wasn't under threat of being bombed, we evacuated, taking only the essentials like food, flour, and our personal bags. We also threw some mattresses and blankets from the window because we had no time to carry them down the stairs. We put them into our two cars and headed to the campus, which was about 200 meters from the towers. When we arrived, we found the campus crammed with people. When we started searching for a corner to put down our things, another airstrike hit, shattering all the windows around us. My family and I were not injured, but I remember a boy whose face was deeply cut by a piece of glass. With every airstrike, I felt as if my heart had been torn out of my chest and then put back in. I'm not sure what type of missiles the Israeli army used, but the explosions caused high-intensity waves of pressure and sound. Although 2.5 years have passed, I still have no words to describe what I saw. The geography of the neighborhood was upended, a destruction that I've never seen before. Ashes covered the whole area, and the piles of rubble were mixed together, blocking the streets. One couldn't recognize their own apartment, and even if they did, they couldn't even reach it because of the humongous piles of rubble. Residents would inspect the area and then leave in tears, not even trying to retrieve anything from the rubble. On that day, most of Al-Zahra was obliterated. Almost all of its residents fled, including people whose apartments were still standing, like us, and relocated either to southern Gaza or back to Gaza City. My family and I went back to Gaza City, staying there and bearing the famine and the constant scenes of death. I have never tried to return to Al-Zahra, but whenever I journey to southern Gaza, I can see it from Al-Rashid Street, flattened and annihilated. Beginning at Nusayrat refugee camp, not a single building has been left standing or unscathed. The scale of destruction is inconceivable. Those are excerpts from How Israel Ravaged Gaza City's Al-Zahra Neighborhood by Amro Rashad Abu Aisha, a student of English, writing from Gaza on electronicintifada.net. And now, as we always do, we wanted to highlight people expressing joy, determination, and reclamation across Palestine and around the world. The co-founders of the newly opened Phoenix Library in Gaza, who collected, repaired, and reshelved hundreds of books from underneath the rubble, held one of their first events. In collaboration with the General Union of Palestinian Writers and Authors, they hosted a reading seminar for the novel A Spark of Fire by the Palestinian author Mahmoud al-Basyuni. The Phoenix Library says, quote, "We are striving to breathe life back into reading." And at the Gaza seashore, Ahmed al-Madhoun captured this video of a father teaching his eager young sons how to fish.
بدك تنزل تصيد كمان
يلا بسرعة
يلا روح يلا اسحب
ثلاثة ما شاء الله.
And that's it for the news roundup. As always, go to electronicintifada.net for much more, especially to read our new features by our brave writers in Gaza. You've been listening to the Electronic Intifada's newscast. I'm Nora Barrows-Friedman. Want to hear more? Check out our live stream with interviews, reports, and analysis, along with print articles, podcasts, and more at electronicintifada.net. Produced by Nora Barrows-Friedman, Tamara Nassar, and Pierre Loisel.
You're listening to Arab Voices, a syndicated radio talk show that airs on dozens of radio stations in the US and Europe since 2002. This is Saeed, executive producer and host of Arab Voices. In March 2026, the Council on American Islamic Relations, CARE, the nation's largest Muslim civil rights and advocacy organization, released its 2026 civil rights report titled The Right to Be Different, which documents a pattern of public officials using their offices to narrow the definitions of what Americans can look like, say, or believe in 2025. CARE held a press conference in March 2026 to talk about the report. Let's listen to the remarks delivered at that press conference by Corey Saylor, CARE's Research and Advocacy Director, and Lina Masri, CARE's National Litigation Director and General Counsel.
Welcome to the release of CARE's 2026 Civil Rights Report, The Right to Be Different. I'm Corey Saylor. I'm the Research and Advocacy Director with CARE. I'll be joined momentarily by our counsel, Lina Masri, who will talk about the legal side of things after I give you the findings of the report. For this year's Civil Rights Report, which the organization has been doing annually since about 1996, we found a number of patterns. And some of those patterns are very important for me to talk about before I get to the data of the report, because they're patterns that impact the Muslim community, but they also affect other Americans as well. And so our first argument that we want to put forward to you is that in 2025, what we saw in the United States was a group of powerful public officials assert that freedom comes with conditions. And those conditions that they placed on freedom are you have to speak their approved lines, you have to worship in ways in which they approve, you should trace your ancestry to places that they approve of, and you should think the thoughts that they approve. And the argument that we as a civil rights organization will put forward is that protecting your right to be different and your right to dissent isn't a favor to any one community. That's the operating system of a free country. Now, there's important civil rights context to what I'm talking about. So when I say that there was this movement to attempt to say that democracy only works for certain people, I happen to think democracy should work for everyone, it's seen in images like this one we picked from the Department of Labor. But there's additional civil rights context that I want you to be aware of. The Department of Homeland Security closed its Office for Civil Rights and Civil Liberties. It closed the Office of the Citizenship and Immigration Services Ombudsman. It closed the Office of the Immigration Detention Ombudsman. And then in Department of Education, we saw their civil rights office essentially stripped down and told to stop working on public cases and start executing cases that were in line with the administration. These are all very important for all Americans, because that is a reduction in the civil rights, civil liberties oversight that you have protecting your rights to be different and to dissent. Now, within that context, there was a very broad attack on Muslim life in 2025. And I'm showing that here through some social media posts by a number of members of Congress. But you'll see this is an extreme type of rhetoric. Pluralism is a lie. Muslims don't belong in American society. Calls for mainstream Muslims to be destroyed. This is an extreme language that is often used to advance extreme policies, and we'll talk about that in just a couple of moments. Final piece of context before we get to the data. To get to what I'm about to talk about, we collect data from all care offices from January to December 2025 on the types of intakes that they did. We also coded 1,897 statements and other things issued by care, and then an almost equal number of news articles, because we often reference those in our press releases. So these patterns that I'm about to talk about come from an enormous amount of information. And the first key finding that we have, Islamophobia remains at an all-time high. In 2025, the organization received 8,683 complaints. That's the highest single year total since we started tracking data in 1996. It's a 0.3 increase over 2024. And if you look at the small circles, you'll see employment discrimination was for the second year in a row our top category. Now, last year I would have stood here and confidently told you that the majority of that employment discrimination was the result of having viewpoints that think Palestinians have humanity that should be honored. This year we can't say that with such certainty, and you'll see why in a few moments. Next key finding. Over the last 3 years, in 5 states, we've seen complaints increase each of those 3 years. That's Florida, Illinois, Minnesota, Oklahoma, and Texas. Remember those names because they're very key to some of the data you'll see in a few moments. Each of those states, though, complaints increase each of the last 3 years. In Minnesota, they received 96% more cases, more complaints in 2025 than they did the previous year. In Illinois, our Chicago office received 65% more cases in 2025 than they did the previous year. And I want to pull Minnesota out for one moment, because 23% of their complaints that they received in 2025 came in the month of December, after President Trump disparaged Somali Americans and then launched Operation Metro Surge. Now, I said remember the names of those states, and I wanted you to do that because Texas is a standout as well in 2025, because Governor Abbott and Attorney General Paxton launched a broad attack on Muslim life in that state, and it seems to have the endpoint of pushing Muslims out of civic and religious protections in the state of Texas. So Governor Abbott went after an Islamic center. He went after Islamic burial practices, Islamic mediation practices, and Islamic schools, and then also care itself. And I want to pause there for a second. Let's talk about the burial practices. So the Texas Funeral Services Commission sends a letter to a mosque and says, we have determined, keyword there, determined that you're in violation of the practices in Texas that are established. And then a few months later, and now I'm not directly quoting, but it's a near quote, the same organization sent a letter to the mosque saying, if we ever receive evidence that you violated the statutes of Texas. So it went from determined to if we ever get evidence. Now, the evidence that did emerge about Texas Funeral Service Commission was that people inside the commission had been sharing Islamophobic content. And when we asked Governor Abbott to investigate that, obviously that landed on deaf ears. Now, the next pattern that I want to call out outside of those five key states is we documented that government officials used collective and ideological punishment to target citizens and non-citizens who are perceived to be ethnically and ideologically undesirable. So, we already talked about Minnesota and the targeting of the Somali community. In the report, we also detail incidents with Afghans and Syrians because those ethnic groups are both majority Muslim. But I want to take a moment now and pause on the ideological punishment. I use four cases to really illustrate the many cases that we saw, but in the cases of Mahmoud Khalil, Rumeysa Ozturk, Badr Khansouri, and Sami Hamdi, what we saw is the government put out on social media vast allegations against each of these individuals. And if you don't remember any of them, Rumeysa Ozturk was the woman who went for a walk and was then in New England and was then surrounded by masked federal agents, whisked off in a van, and then moved around the country, which is usually done to make it hard for your attorneys to find you. And it took a year, some of that time she was in detention, for her to be essentially cleared of all the charges against her. And what comes out is that she wrote an op-ed in a school newspaper asking that the school consider divesting from Israel because that state is engaged in genocide and apartheid. So the government would make these vast allegations against people. When that went to court, they weren't able to back those allegations up time and time again. And so what we see is that the government, as soon as the Trump administration came in, they started identifying people who value Palestinian humanity and oppose apartheid and oppose occupation and oppose genocide as inherently threatening and also inherently biased. And Rumeysa Ozturk, Badr Khansouri, Mahmoud Khalil, Sami Hamdi are examples of what was done to people, essentially in an effort to silence them. The other thing that we see, anti-Muslim narratives resurfaced in 2025 in a way we hadn't seen in many years. So you heard me earlier say that with the employment discrimination, I can't say with full comfort what we think was the major driver of that. And that's because these anti-Muslim narratives that were very prevalent 2010 through 2017 made a comeback. So a couple of examples for you. First and foremost, in Texas, we already talked about that, this broad attack on Muslim life simply for being Muslim. In Florida, we saw a similar broad attack on Muslims simply for being Muslim. So in that state, they tried to pass legislation that would essentially ban the practice of Islam in the state. They went after Islamic schools, and they also went after this organization. In December, two members of Congress, Chip Roy, Keith Self, both from Texas, there comes that state again, launched what's known as the Sharia Free America Caucus. And this caucus is advancing legislation that, again, at the federal level, would essentially ban the practice of the faith of Islam in the United States, the world's second largest religion. That caucus, as of the last time I saw, now has 45 or 46 members. And then finally, in terms of these narratives resurfacing, Director of National Intelligence Tulsi Gabbard spoke at a Talking Points U.S. gathering in December, and there she talked about, again, Sharia is somehow taking over the United States, and she pointed specifically to a town in New Jersey and a town in Texas. So these views had essentially gone into the background for quite some time, but now they're being spoken again from the highest offices in this country. A couple of final points before I invite my colleague up to make a couple of remarks. One, 2025, what we saw is civil rights violations increasingly occur through executive actions, memos, proclamations, threats of investigations, or threats, not necessarily discriminatory laws. And that bypasses the usual civil rights protections that we have in place because the legal system has certain higher standards. You have to be able to prove things. If I write a memo or a proclamation, the onus, the burden of defense is on whatever group of people that I just targeted with that speech. So this is a way to sort of get the ends that they're looking for, which is pushing Muslims outside the protected circle of civic and religious life in the United States without having to go through the due process norms that we as a nation value. As we always have, civil rights defenders asserted our rights to be different and to dissent in 2025. And what we find in the report, and the reason why our counsel is here with me today, is because courts were one of the best correctives for these abuses. The issue that I'll call out is that courts take time. So while it's one of the best interventions, someone like Rumeysa Ozturk has to go through a year of her life, part of that in detention, in order to prove the innocence that the government was never even actually able to challenge in court. So courts were one of the key correctives that we saw. Public pressure was also a key corrective. We spoke about Operation Metro Surge earlier. Everyone now knows that the cruel, and I would argue police state style tactics that were used by ICE in Minnesota saw tons of public pushback, saw tons of public pressure, saw many Americans go out into the streets and attempt to record the abuses that were going on. And that cost two people their lives, but that public pressure ultimately resulted in ICE deciding to draw down their numbers. So a couple of last thoughts. Central takeaway from 2025 is not that American Muslims lack legal rights. It is equal protection increasingly requires an active defense. Equal access to social opportunities, education, travel, civic participation becomes increasingly contingent on your political alignment, your decision to silence yourself, or your litigation capacity. So what do we ask for people to think about? We're essentially asking you, make a choice, then act. Does freedom in the United States mean the right to be different and to dissent? Or is it the right to be part of a uniform society where everybody conforms to the viewpoints of a few who dictate to us how we have to think, how we have to look, how we have to worship, and where we have to come from? Thank you very much. That's the summary of the report, and I'd like to invite Lena Masri up to speak about some of the legal issues that the organization is working on.
My name is Lena Masri. I'm the CARE National Litigation Director and General Counsel. The Civil Rights Report being released today documents a reality that Muslims across this country are experiencing every day. Last year alone, CARE received 8,683 civil rights complaints nationwide, the highest number recorded since the organization began documenting these incidents nearly three decades ago. But the most important thing to understand about this report is that it is not simply a collection of individual incidents. It reflects a broader landscape. Across the country, Muslims are increasingly being treated as though their participation in American civic life is conditional on how they worship, conditional on what they say, and conditional on whether their views are considered acceptable by those in power. One of the clearest examples of this trend is the growing effort to silence advocacy for Palestinian human rights. The report documents how speech supporting Palestinian rights has increasingly been framed as suspicious or threatening, and how that framing has been used to justify government investigations, campus discipline, and even immigration enforcement actions against individuals because of their political views. At universities across the country, students and faculty who spoke out about Gaza faced suspension, surveillance, or threats to their immigration status. In several cases, courts have already intervened to reaffirm that the First Amendment protects this speech, even when the speech is controversial. At the same time, we saw government officials use the authority of their offices to portray Muslim institutions and Muslim advocacy as inherently suspicious. In Texas and Florida, state leaders took the extraordinary step of issuing official actions attempting to brand one of the country's largest Muslim civil rights organization, this organization, as a terrorist group, an unprecedented use of government power that courts are now reviewing. These are not isolated incidents. They represent a pattern in which public officials test the boundaries of the Constitution by attempting to redefine who is allowed to participate fully in American civic life. But there is another part of this story, and that is what happens when these actions are tested in court. Just yesterday, a federal jury returned a $667,000 verdict in favor of Muslim men who were pepper sprayed and beaten by prison guards while praying together inside a Missouri correctional facility. These men were engaged in the simple act of religious worship. Instead of being allowed to pray, they were surrounded by guards, sprayed with chemical agents, beaten, and then placed in solitary confinement without being allowed to wash the pepper spray from their bodies. A jury heard that evidence and found that prison officials violated their constitutional rights. That verdict sends a clear message. Even inside a prison, the Constitution still applies. The First Amendment does not disappear because people exercising it are Muslim. And that is an important reminder as we look at the civil rights landscape described in this report. Because the story of Muslim civil rights in America today is not only about discrimination, it is also about the rule of law. Again and again, when these cases reach the courts, judges and juries reaffirm the same basic constitutional principle. In the United States, the government does not get to decide whose speech is acceptable, whose religion is legitimate, or whose participation in civic life is allowed. That is what this report ultimately documents. A moment of real pressure on Muslim civil rights, but also a moment where the Constitution continues to provide a powerful check on the misuse of government authority. And every time those constitutional protections are enforced, they strengthen the rights of every American. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Lena. We have one question that we wanted to respond to, and then we'll wrap up. This is a question actually that's been posed by a number of members of Congress recently about Islam's role in the United States. So here is an answer to the question that they've been raising. Islam is an American religion. Islam arrived in the United States in numbers, Muslims, in the colonial era, and they arrived in the holds of slave ships in chains. So the faith has been present in the United States since before the United States itself formed. Now, these Muslims did not have religious liberty. They did not have individual liberty. They were not able to go to Philadelphia and contribute to writing the founding documents because they were working on plantations. This history goes up to the present day. Muslim names show up in Revolutionary War muster rolls. Muslim names are present in the rolls of people who fought in the Civil War and all the way forward. So anyone who tries to deny that Islam arrived early, followed by a number of other faiths, making America a country where many different religions are present and came in different ways and contribute in different ways. Anyone who attempts to say that our country is anything other than a nation where many faiths thrive and that Islam is an American religion is deceiving you for their own purposes. And we should all be very clear and aware of why politicians are putting forward certain agendas to exclude Americans from the ability to participate in the civic and religious life of this country. That ends our press conference. Thank you all very much for giving us your time. We appreciate it.
What you just heard were the remarks delivered at a press conference held by CARE, the Council on American Islamic Relations, about the newly released 2026 Civil Rights Report titled The Right to be Different, which documents a pattern of public officials using their offices to narrow the definitions of what Americans can look like, say, or believe in 2025. I have a link to the full report on our website, arabvoices.net. It is also posted on the organization's website, www.cair.com. You're listening to Arab Voices, a syndicated radio talk show that airs on dozens of radio stations in the US and Europe since 2002. This is Saeed, executive producer and host of Arab Voices. One of the ministries in apartheid Israel, named, quote, Ministry of Diaspora Affairs and Combating Anti-Semitism, unquote, published a list of what it described as the top 10 most influential figures in the global, quote, anti-Semitic and anti-Zionist arena, unquote. The list includes 10 people, including Greta Thunberg, Bassem Youssef, Candace Owens, Abdel Bari Atwan, Tucker Carlson, and Imam Omar Sliman. Dr. Omar Sliman, who is a prominent Palestinian-American imam, scholar, civil rights activist, public speaker, author, and founder of Yaqeen Institute, responded to the Israeli government's list that included his name with the following message.
All right, everyone. It's official. I can retire now. My work here is done. Israel just listed me amongst its top 10 prominent anti-Semitic influencers of 2025. And you can see here, you know, it puts people like Tucker Carlson and Greta Thunberg. And it has these red triangles, ironically, pointing towards us, it seems. And I just want everyone to kind of take a step back and realize that this, to me, is nothing but another sign of Israel's panic and the fact that they know that their propaganda is not working and that people can see right through it. And I've been sent this list now so many times over the last 3 days. It's crazy. I've been sent this list by people in the Arab world. I've been sent this list by people, obviously, that are seeing it now pop up on English news sites. And I want everyone to understand that as Palestinians, we take this as a badge of honor, that they're panicking, that they're falling apart, and they know they're falling apart. In fact, it was really interesting when I sent this to my father, he responded with, congrats, you made the honor list. Literally says, you made the honor list. And you would think, like, this is a man that was born 5 years before the state of Israel even existed. He was born in Palestine as a free Palestinian and has spent his entire life facing the consequences of the occupation and fighting through the consequences of the occupation, coming here to the United States, becoming a professor, debating, taking out ads in local newspapers, doing everything he could to expose the crimes of the state, taking us as children to protests so that we could, you know, feel that same sense of responsibility to our homeland and to this cause. And he's not afraid, because none of us are afraid, and no one should be afraid. I also want you to realize that this is not about me, and this is not about anyone else but you. This is actually about your ability to speak up. This is because Israel does not want people critiquing its crimes, and because they can't withstand the scrutiny, they resort to intimidation time and time again, and they become more ridiculous with every single attempt that they make. And so, if you look at the examples that they used for my supposed anti-Semitism, I just want you to look at the two things they put in their report. The first one is children's limbs stolen in Gaza, children's lives stolen in the West Bank. Children in Palestine continue to wonder why the world does nothing to stop their occupiers. Does that sound anti-Semitic to you? The second post is, for every single voice that you seek to silence, a million will speak in their place. My brief address at the National March on Washington today, this was dedicated to our brave student activists arbitrarily detained by ICE at the behest of Israel. Does it sound anti-Semitic to you, right? They've broadened the definition of anti-Semitism so much that it's become inconsequential. And they've tried so hard to make anti-Zionism a form of anti-Semitism because they're not actually trying to protect Jewish people anywhere. They're trying to protect themselves and shield themselves from any accountability for their crimes, which have now been laid bare for the entire world to see. And so, Israel, we're not afraid of you. And I want you to know, whoever compiled this report, that we're going to do everything that we possibly can do to make sure that we're on your 2026 report and your 2027 report, or however long you continue to traffic in this nonsense. And I want to send a message especially to those that are concerned or to the activists, first and foremost to those that have actually been doxxed by Israel, because these shady watch lists have been, you know, put through all sorts of systems and institutions in the United States. And that should be a cause of concern for any American, that it's not just your politicians that are responding to lobbies. It's not just your mainstream media newsrooms. It's your academic institutions that are responding to watch lists on professors and expelling students on behalf of official Israeli government agencies, and people getting fired from hospitals, and law students never being able to find work because of these watch lists that are being published. That at the end of the day, for me, all I've really seen is an uptick in hack attempts, desperate attempts to run ads on my name. And so, yes, they've tried to hack multiple devices and multiple accounts. They've also, from the very beginning of this genocide, put official Israeli propaganda on search results on my name and many other people. They have obviously trafficked in smear campaigns, and, you know, we've seen all these bots that go into comments on every single social media platform and try to amplify, originate or amplify smear campaigns that will work with that audience. So if it's towards a Muslim audience or towards a non-Muslim audience, because obviously their goal is to delegitimize. But at the end of the day, like, if I get shadow banned or if a whole bunch of people believe something about me that's not true, I still have my job. I still have my livelihood. The fact that school teachers and med students and law grads are getting fired because of this, because they dare critique Israel, should be alarming to each and every single one of you, right? And that should be something that you think about. And that should be, if anything, the motivation for us to continue and to call out these types of attempts so that they no longer work. And so my message to Israel, I'm an imam, I can't curse. So I'll try to keep this as PG as possible. I'm just going to say, we're not afraid of you, and we're going to keep on doing this. My message to everyone else is keep going and do not be afraid. And at the end of the day, these attempts will become more pathetic and pitiful, and our efforts will become more organized and unifying and make evident not just the crimes of the state of Israel against innocent people, but the imperative for everyone to take a moral stand against apartheid, against genocide, against occupation. So thank you for your concern. I'm not actually retiring. Assalamu alaikum.
That was Dr. Omar Sliman, a prominent Palestinian-American imam, scholar, civil rights activist, public speaker, author, and founder of Yaqeen Institute, responding to the Israeli government's so-called top 10 prominent anti-Semitic influencers list that included his name. You've been listening to Arab Voices, a syndicated radio talk show that airs on dozens of radio stations in the U.S. and Europe since 2002. Our shows are archived online, and you can listen to them by visiting arabvoices.net. And that does it for the show today. Thanks for listening. This is Saeed, executive producer and host of Arab Voices. Until we meet next week, peace on earth.